Romans chapter 7, starting in verse 15 is where we're going to pick it up tonight. See if we can finish the end of the chapter. I've got kind of a working title for tonight. My working title is The Willing and the Doing. I thought about calling it a Tale of Two Laws, but I don't have time to get into that, so we won't talk about that. So, The Willing and the Doing, verses 15 through 25 of Romans chapter 7. Paul starts off in verse 15. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. Now, some of this stuff in some of these verses coming up in Romans can sound kind of confusing. And it can kind of sound like, what in the world is he talking about? But boy, some important verses here in Romans chapter 7 that if we get a hold of it, one of the things I want to talk about is there's a word in the Greek where it's translated for what I will to do, what I will to do. You don't see some of this stuff in the English. And so I want to try to bring out some of this. I can't bring out all of it because I had like 13 pages of notes. Otherwise, if I have 8 pages of notes, we're going real long. And so I've got 8 pages of notes now. I got down to 8, but there's just so much in here. There are at least 3 important words that are translated throughout the whole passage: to do, to have action, to take action, to perform, to practice. Significant things. I don't have time for all that stuff. One of the words I do want to make sure that we talk about, and it's the word to do. It's the Greek word to do, the Greek word thelo. It can be translated to will, to have in mind, to intend, to be resolved or determined, to purpose, to like to do a thing, to be fond of doing a thing, to delight in something. You know, it's something I want to do. We'd use this word thelo. And you're going to see this word. I mean, this isn't like in every verse of the Bible. This is not that common of a word. I mean, it's around. It's around. But in these 10, 11 verses that we're doing, it's in these verses 7 times. This idea of what do you want to do? What's your will? What's your desire? What are you fond of doing? And what's confusing in the English is that we use this word W-I-L-L, will. See, we use it different ways. We use it sometimes in English to express future tense. Like, tomorrow I will go to the store. And we stick that word will in there. And to talk about something that's in the future. Are you with me? Are you with me? But that's not what he's talking about here. So don't get, if you're thinking something in the future, when you see the word will pop up through this passage, you're going to get confused. He's talking will in the sense of, this is something I want. This is something I desire. And so he says, for what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I, you might say, for what I want to do, that I do not practice. For what I hate, that I do. So this idea, and it's going to be throughout this passage, it expresses a person's desire, their self-will. It's a choice they make. It's found here in verse 15. It's found again in verse 16 where he says, if then I do what I will not to do. That's that same word. If I'm doing something that I don't want to do, he says, then I agree with the law. It's in verse 18. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. See, I have a desire, a want in me. It's used again in verse 19. And in fact, one of the things I would do, if I were you, I would circle these little words will and draw a line, connect them, so that you understand this is all the same word throughout this passage. In verse 19, it's used twice. For the good that I will to do, I do not. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. He's talking about your desires, what you desire, what you don't desire. It's used again in verse 20. Now, if I do what I will not to do, and then he goes on with the verse. And one last time in verse 21, I find in a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good, the one who has a desire to do good. And yet I've got this thing about evil in me. So that's kind of an important word throughout this whole passage. That's why one of my titles for this passage is The Willing and the Doing. See, I have this conflict. The things I want to do are not always the things that I do. I have desires, but I don't always do them. This passage is all about being frustrated. It's all about, you know, at the end he goes, "Oh, wretched man that I am." And I almost feel like by the time you get through this passage and you've dug through this, I feel sick to my stomach. It's just like, oh, man. Because that's the way we are, isn't it? I want to do the right thing, but I don't always do the right thing. Now, please put me at ease here. Is there anybody in this room besides me who ever experiences this? Where you want to do what's right, but you don't always do it. In fact, he says, the things that I hate are the ones I end up doing. So, I'm not alone, right? Thank you. A few of you that raised your hand, I'm glad I'm not alone in here. Okay, good. So, he says, for what I am doing, I don't understand this. For what I will, what I want to do, that, he says, I do not practice. Another word here, the word for practice. To exercise, to practice, to be busy with. It carries the idea of intended, earnest, habitual performance. An action that has direction and purpose in it. It's something that you do over and over again. It's, you know, whether it's practicing the piano or doing your exercises, working out. It's something that you do over and over again. He says, for what I want to do, that I do not. I don't, it's not a practice of my life. It's not a habit in my life. I want to do the right things, but it's not always the way it works out. He says, I do not understand these things. I do not understand these things. Now, sometimes in our lives, we are totally screwing up our life. And it's no surprise that we're doing stupid things. Because we've started down a path and we're doing one thing after another, and after another. And at those occasions, it's not like we can't say, I don't understand. Because I do understand. I know that there's a reason why I'm in this mess I'm in. Okay? But what really gets confusing is when I've been going through a period of my life where I've been following the Lord, where I've been reading my Bible, where I've been going to church, I've been doing all the right things. And then it hits me in the face. And I do something and screw up. And that's where I relate this. How can this be? I don't get this. Why do I do this? Here I've been doing all the right things. I'm doing all the things Pastor Rich tells me to do. And then I go and I screw up. He says, I don't understand. What was I thinking? If you ever take a note, this is what I wrote. I would write down, what was I thinking? You know, we go through these things in our life and we think, what was I thinking when I did that? An intern writes, I'm a medical student currently doing a rotation in toxicology at the Poison Control Center. Today, this woman called in very upset because she caught her little daughter eating ants. Mr. Exterminator, okay, so the little girl's eating ants. I quickly reassured her that ants are not harmful and there's no need to bring her daughter into the hospital. She calmed down and at the end of the conversation happened to mention that she'd also given her daughter some ant poison in order to kill the ants. So I told her she should bring her daughter into the hospital. What was she thinking? What was she thinking? It seems a few years ago, there were some Boeing employees on the field. They decided to steal a life raft from one of the 747s. They were successful in getting it out of the plant and home. They took it for a float on the Stillaguamish River, and they were quite surprised by a Coast Guard helicopter homing in on the emergency locator beacon that was activated when they inflated the raft. They're no longer employed by Boeing. What were they thinking? What were they thinking? Police in Radnor, Pennsylvania, interrogated a suspect by placing a metal colander on his head and connecting it with wires to a photocopy machine. the message, "He's lying," was placed on the copier, and the police pressed the copy button each time they thought he wasn't telling the truth. The guy thought it was a real lie detector machine, and he told them the truth. What was he thinking? Now, I got to tell you, I got some of these stories off of very old emails that I got, so I don't really even know if these things are the truth. But who needs stupid stories about idiots when we've got our own lives to look at? What were we thinking? What was I thinking? Paul says, "For what I'm doing, I do not understand." What was I? What am I thinking about? You ever experienced this frustration? Okay, verse 16. "If then I do what I will not to do," if I'm doing the things that I don't do, that I don't want to do, he says, "I agree with the law that it is good." Now, he's going to use the word law in a couple different ways, but here he's still talking about the law of Moses, which he's been talking about throughout the chapter. And he's saying, when I do a stupid thing that's a sin, I look at God's law and I realize, you know what? God's law was right. My sin is ugly and stupid. Yes, I agree. Verse 17. "But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me." Now, it kind of sounds like Paul saying, "It's not my fault. It's not my fault." Do you ever think of that when you read this passage? Looks like he's saying, "It's not my fault." And that's not what he's saying. Because if you pay attention to what he's saying, he talks about it's the sin that dwells in me. It's the problem is in me. It's the problem that is right now currently living at home in me. It is me. He's not saying that he's not responsible for his bad actions, like this guy. In Lodi, California, in March of 2006, a city dump truck backed into Curtis Gokey's car. The car was damaged badly, so Gokey sued the city of Lodi for $3,600 because the truck backed into his pickup truck. There's a catch to the story. Curtis Gokey was driving the city dump truck when he backed into his own car. And he admitted it was his fault. And so the city dropped the lawsuit and said that he could not sue himself. Mr. Gokey has no one to blame but himself. He can't say, "It's not my fault." See, we want to get off the hook and say, "It's not my fault." But that's not what Paul's saying. Paul's saying that after becoming a Christian, something happens in us, and there's a split that takes place. Actually, what it is there's an additional nature that's put into me. There's a good nature that's put into me. The Spirit of God. We call it being born again. And so that I start to experience a struggle, a new struggle. There's a part of me that wants to do right, and that's the part that God has given life to. But there's still this old sin nature, this part of me that wants to do bad. We might call it Jekyll and Hyde. You remember the old horror movies? Actually, what I remember are the Bugs Bunny cartoons with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know. It comes from this short story from, it's Robert Louis Stevenson that wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it's about a London lawyer who investigates these strange occurrences between his old friend Dr. Henry Jekyll and the evil Mr. Edward Hyde. We get the idea of a split personality coming from this story, that people have multiple personalities, and that's kind of where these ideas start from, is Jekyll and Hyde. But the idea here in this passage is not about split personalities, and yet there's sometimes our lives are a bit like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, aren't they? Kind of like, who are you today? You know? Paul's trying to teach the truth that there's this dual nature inside of the Christian. Journalist Hunter Thompson longtime contributor to Rolling Stone magazine, the author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He committed suicide at age 67 about 3 years ago. His addiction to drugs and alcohol and his abusive actions towards others were no secret. After his death, his first wife, Sandy Conklin Thompson, wrote, "He was, on the one hand, extremely loving and tender, brilliant, exciting, generous, and kind. On the other hand, end of the spectrum, he was extremely cruel. I will never forget something Hunter once said to me. In one of his tender moments, I asked him if he knew when he was about to become the monster. He said, 'Sandy, it's like this. I sense it first, and before I have completely turned around, he is there. He is me.'" And maybe we may not be as much of an exaggeration as Mr. Thompson was, but we all kind of know what that's like, don't we? You know? There's a sense in which we have a new life as a Christian, but we would be foolish to think that the old nature is gone. We will quote sometimes verses, and I will hear people quote these verses to people. 2 Corinthians 5:17, "Behold, if any man is in Christ, he's a new creation, and the old things have passed away, and all things have become new." There is a truth to that. But beloved, if you think the old man is gone, you're wrong. Paul writes in Galatians 5:17, he says, "For the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish." There's this battle that goes on in every Christian between the flesh, the sin nature, the part of me, the old part of me, and the new part of me, the part that God has put inside of me. I have two dueling natures inside of me, both trying to come out on top. And I will never be completely rid of my sin nature until my physical body is gone and dead. And that doesn't mean you go out and commit suicide. And that doesn't mean we're all going to have a special Kool-Aid drink afterwards for everyone who wants to do this. That's not what we're talking about. But we just need to understand this is going to be part of life, is always learning to put down the old man and to build up the new. Verse 18, Paul says this, "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells." In my flesh, the word for flesh, it can mean this stuff that's covering your bones and your muscles, but it also is a term that is used to talk about that part of me that loves to rebel against God, the part that's prone to sin, that's opposed to God. He says, "I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells." In our passage, there's two different words for good, and they're close, and it's not that big of a deal whether you get this or not. It's just kind of interesting to hear some of the flavor differences. The word that's used here, agathos, I guess we get Agatha Christie from it or something like that, you know. Agathos means, it has to do with, it says, "of good constitution or nature, useful, a gift which is truly a gift, good, pleasant, agreeable, goodness from the inside." That's the important thing to think of. This word, agathos, means good on the inside. It's good at the core. And he says, in my flesh, in that sin nature part of me, there is nothing that's good at the core. There is nothing that is good at the core. This is a big principle, gang. You should write this one down. No good thing. In my flesh dwells no good thing. When I do not live under the influence, under the empowering of the Spirit of God, that's when I'm living in my flesh. And if I think that there's anything good that I can produce without having yielded my life to God, I'm fooling myself. If I get up in the morning and I think, well, you know, I'm not going to really surrender my heart to the Lord today because I don't know if I want Him telling me what to do today, but I'll still go to church and do my thing at church. Heaven help us. My flesh accomplishes nothing. There's not a single thing that is good or right. And yet, there is this part in us that thinks that it doesn't hurt to spoil the flesh every once in a while. You know, every once in a while the flesh cries out, "I'm hungry, feed me, just a tiny morsel, it wouldn't hurt." And so we get up in the morning, and instead of building up the spirit part of us, we feed the flesh a little bit. And I get sidetracked. And I go after one thing after another. And the day is tough, isn't it? What does it mean to feed the flesh? What am I talking about? Am I talking about what kind of food? What's your diet? Kinda. Look at Galatians chapter 5, verse 19. Galatians chapter 5, verse 19. You know this passage as the deeds of the flesh. Look at Galatians chapter 5, verse 19. Just a little bit to the right of Romans. Galatians 5, verse 19. Paul says this, "The works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I have also told you in the past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of life." If this is the way your life looks, you're in trouble. Now, let me just pick out a couple of these things. What kinds of things, let's put it this way, we're talking about what feeds the flesh. What kind of things feed fornication, or the word means immorality, impure ideas, sex outside of marriage? What kind of things do we do that feed that? This is group participation time. This is not Rich says everything at this point. Ron. Okay, well, we're going to just let you speak as someone who has observed others doing this. Huh?
The internet,
sure. If you're not watching what you're doing on the internet, man, you are going to be feeding this stuff. And you will wonder why your mind is in the gutter. Why do we wonder about that? Why do we wonder about that? What else feeds immorality?
Movies.
Movies, uh-huh. HBO, there you go. TV in general. Media. Okay. See, these kind of things, this is one of the ways, these are some of the ways that we feed the flesh. That's sin nature. And if I'm not careful, and that's what I'm building up in my life, that's what I'm putting into my life, well, I get myself into trouble. Now, another word here, it says in verse 20, it mentions sorcery. Now, that's the Greek word pharmakia. I don't know if that, you know, what does that sound like? A pharmakia, it's drugs. Yeah, that's drugs. You're right. So what kind of things, now not that any of you, of course, a bunch of you are all druggies. So what am I saying? What kind of things cause people to have trouble with drugs?
Parting with the wrong people.
You've heard. That's right. Not that you know anything about that, Cricket. But you understand how this works, huh? Huh? It's the idea of where you're allowing your head to go, where your thoughts are going. How about the, let's see, we talked about the drugs. How about hatred? I mean, you go through each one of these things. And there are things that we do that feed this stuff. What feeds hatred? Driving on the freeway. Okay. Huh? Grudges? Forgiveness? But you know, really, for me, what I'm finding driving on the freeway, it's not driving on the freeway, it's driving on the freeway and not having enough time to get to where I'm going. That's what gets me into trouble. Now, it may not be what gets anybody else into trouble. But you know, taking Timothy to school today, and some jerk was parked in this spot where you're supposed to take a shortcut here, and somebody's parked there, and so it just took us like an extra 5 minutes to get him to school, and I was just like, you know, just talking, thinking about all the idiots that there are in the world, you know, but what does that come from? It's for me, I have to back up. Well, you know, what's the thoughts that set it up? You know, well, probably because I'm trying to burn the candle at both ends and not leaving enough cushion, not leaving enough margin in my life that I snap at people. Something I was thinking about today. I was thinking that for me, a red buzzer in my head that there's something wrong in my life is when I start getting mad at everybody. And my family knows it. They know when I'm a booger at home. And my wife knows when, you know, she's got to walk around on tiptoes because I'm just angry. And you know what that should be tipping me off? That something's feeding my flesh. I need to pay attention. I need to stop getting angry at everybody else and realize there's something going on in me. The problem is in me, not everybody else. You with me? Understand what I'm saying? He mentions envy. What are the things, what are the kind of things that we do? And see, I'm just picking some of these things. There's like a huge grocery list here. What kind of things feed envy?
Comparisons.
Yeah, I don't, you know, the kind of car you drive in. What was that car? How much did you pay for that? You know, and we do that. Yeah, that gets us into big trouble. Big trouble as a pastor. You know, you get together with other pastors and they start telling you, and I know this. I know this. I'm not going to go down there. But somebody tells me how many people are in their church, you know. And that just, you know, just gets you all fleshed out. You got to watch the things that feed the flesh. And so, you know, when I think about the things that, you know, I'm gonna dangle a little treat here, feed my flesh just a little bit. Be careful there. Watch out there. You know, because, you know, it's going to rise up like this, you know, Mr. Hyde is going to come out of the woodworks. Where'd that come from? Where'd that outburst of anger came from? Well, probably I'm feeding this sucker somewhere. When I start my day off feeding these kind of things, I that's what it means to get up on the wrong side of the bed. A gal named Kathy Fussell writes this. She says, I have found that if I don't have my quiet time each morning, I tend to lose my temper over insignificant things. Amen, Kathy. That's. Recently, she says, my son Andrew reminded me of the need for daily prayer. He had accidentally spilled his drink, and I went off into a tirade. Andrew ended my harsh words when he quietly asked, Mommy, did you forget to ask Jesus to help you be nice today? Ouch. Ouch. Sometimes we get to thinking that we've reformed our flesh enough. We get to think that we're no longer going to stumble in a particular area. So we can loosen up a little bit. And what we're doing is we're putting confidence in our flesh. And Paul says, I've come to learn, I imagine the hard way, that no good thing dwells in my flesh. I can't turn my back on it in a sense. I can't think it's all taken care of. You know, I'm all done with drinking. That's not a problem with me anymore. Whoa, danger, Will Robinson. You know, I don't have this problem anymore. I think we better watch out, Buckaroo. You're in dangerous territory. Need to starve that sucker and don't feed it. Verse 18. So he says, for I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. No good thing. Verse 18. For to will, that's that word again, for to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good, I do not find. Now it says, to will is present with me. That idea, that desire, I actually have a desire to do the good thing. It says it's present with me. The Greek word for present means to lie beside, to be near, to be present at hand. It's right there. I've got a desire to do good, but how to perform it, what is good, I do not find. Now, Here's where it's kind of interesting. The word good, the second good. See, there's two goods in this passage. This word, this good, has to do with things good on the outside. The first one was inner goodness. This one is outer goodness, what everybody else sees, the good works that you do. Paul's saying that on the inside, there's nothing good on the inside of him. In addition, he doesn't even have the ability to do what's outwardly recognized as good. You know, I know that there's nothing good inside of me, but every once in a while I can fake it. You know, he says, tell you the truth, I'm not even good at faking it. So that's what he's kind of saying. He's got inside's raunchy, the outside, that's not doing so good either. This idea of outward goodness. How often do we have great ideas of how we're going to live? You know, we go on the retreat and we make all these promises to God. You know, if you've been to as many retreats as I've been, after a while it gets kind of old, doesn't it? You know, I remember years ago we used to whip people up and make them promise to do this and to do that, and I kind of don't, I'm not real excited about that anymore. I'd rather try to work at teaching daily living than making just grand old promises. In Matthew 26, verses 40 to 41, it says, he came to the disciples and found them asleep, and he said to Peter, what? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. See, there's a desire to do good, but man, in that sin nature, I'm just having a hard time, right? Am I the only one in here that this speaks to? No, it's all of us. Verse 19, he goes on. I wish he would stop. Maybe I need to go faster through this passage. There we go. Let's just read it and be done with. Verse 19. For the good that I will to do, I do not. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. That's that word practice. That's that, you know, doing your piano lessons. You know, he says, so I want it. There's a good that I have this desire to do, that I'm not doing that. But the evil that I don't want to do, that's the thing I'm just doing over and over and over again. You know, I remember as a kid, I had piano lessons, and I hated to practice. Absolutely hated to practice. I have since come to find, by just miraculous experience, you don't get nowhere on the keyboard if you don't practice. If you don't get the scales down, if you don't learn the finger exercises, man, you're just going to stink when you get up on the piano. Nobody's going to want to listen to you. You've got to practice. But this problem I have, Paul says, is I'm practicing all the wrong things. I'm practicing all the things that stink. That is misery, isn't it? That's misery. See, God puts this new nature in me. There's something in me that wants to do good, and I'm not doing it. Verse 20. Now, if I do what I will not to do, if I'm doing the things that I don't want to do, he says, it is no longer I who do it, but the sin that dwells in me. Again, Paul's not saying it's not his fault. He's pointing to the Jekyll Hyde thing. He's pointing to this split nature. Verse 21, I find then a law that evil is present with me. The one who wills to do good. The one who wants to do good. I've got this strange thing. He says, I find a law. And the word here, law, he's not talking about the law of Moses. He's talking about the law in a general sense, like a principle. I found a principle that evil is present with me. We call this depravity. This is what we call depravity. There you go. There's a theological word that you're learning tonight. Depravity. And it's what each of us have. We have this thing in us that does not want to do the right thing, that ends up doing. All of us are capable of great evil. Sometimes, you know, in the news, they show people who do these horrendous things and they kill all these people and stuff, and we think, oh my gosh, what a horrible person. But the sad news is, gang, it's no different than any of us. We are all capable of horrendous evil. That's just human nature. That's who we are. I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. Verse 22. For I delight in the law of God. according to the inward man. Now, here's the contrast. Here's the contrast. I got this thing, I've got this evil in me, and yet, he says, I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. The word delight, interesting word. Sunedomai. Sun means with, and edomai means to take pleasure, to rejoice with. The word edomai, it comes from hedone, where we get our word hedonism. You know what hedonism is? That's just, I just live for pleasure. Pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. Just do whatever feels good. That's, we call that hedonism. We normally think of that in a bad sense. You with me? Please? I didn't show you pictures of hedonism because I did not want to feed anybody's flesh. Okay? We could translate this, I delight with the law of God, because it's sun edone. It's with this delight. It's, I have this delight. This is what's so confusing with me. Is that part of me, this evil part of me, the evil nature, the dark side, wants to do wrong. But what's so confusing is that there's a part of me, what God has done in me, that takes great delight. Just like, to do good, to do the right thing. There's, as a Christian, there's a part of me that absolutely thrills to do what God wants. Isn't that true? Isn't that true? When we think about, I think about Matthew 25. Is that the talents? And the end of the age, the servants come before the king and shows the king what they've done with this money that he's given them, the talents. And the master says to the servants, well, at least for the first two of them, they'll forget the last one, but the first two, the one that made five, the one that made three, he says, well done, good and faithful servant. I don't know about you, but part of me leaps inside when I hear that. Because I want to hear that. I long for the day that we will see Jesus face to face. And the greatest desire in my heart is to hear him say, good job, Rich. Good job. I long for that. I long for that. I think about my dad having gone to heaven this year. You know what? I think he probably's heard that. You know, I think he's probably heard, good job, Richard Sr. You know, I long for that. Don't you long for that? That's what makes this chapter so confusing. Because we've got this battle in us. There's part of us that, man, you turn your back on it and it's off to do evil. But you know what? When you've been born again, there is a part of you that thrills with the law of God to do what's right. To do what's right. I delight with the law of God according to the inward man, inside, verse 23, but I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind. See, the mind is where he's got this thrill to do what's right. I see this other thing warring, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. Now, there's a lot in this verse because of time. It's all in the cutting room floor. Sorry. The one word I want to just point out here in verse 23 is the word I see. For I see another law in my members. This is an ordinary, everyday Greek word. It's one of the first words you learn in first year Greek is the word to see, blepo. It just means to see. Open your eyes and see. Okay? Just open your eyes and see. And the reason I want to point this out, why it's important here, is because Paul is making an observation from real life. He's looking in the mirror. He's not trying to pretend about his life. He's not trying to pretend that he doesn't have any problems. He opens his eyes and he says, you know what? I see we have a problem. The problem is, I've got this conflict going on inside of me. He sees the reality of sin in his own law as this law that's in my members, that's warring against this law in my mind. Part of me wants to rebel against God, and part of me wants to honor him. I see this. Pay attention. Open your eyes. Verse 24. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? O wretched man that I am. The word wretched means something of enduring toils and troubles, being afflicted, being wretched. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? There's the beginning of a principle here. And I would call it this: victory comes from defeat. Victory comes when you get to this place. O wretched man that I am. I kind of think that we don't get the breakthrough with sin until we get this. If you don't have the anguish over your sin, if you aren't sick of your sin, I don't think you've got the drive to stop your sin. You with me? Don't they call this hitting bottom or something? You know? I remember in my own life at times where I have just felt physically sick over my sin. And that's when I took the steps to do something about it. I think I'll read this guy's story. A guy from Minnesota. Watching the things on TV, the election stuff, we've been learning, you've seen Minnesota. This guy's from Minnesota. I said, some years ago, while our family was vacationing in northern Minnesota, we decided to visit a small country fair near the town of Babbitt. There weren't many people there that morning. In fact, this reminded me of something that we did once. It says, in fact, we were about the only ones visiting the carnival ride. So when I climbed into the tilt-a-wheel with my three kids, we hoped the operator would give us a decent ride, even though we were the only ones on it. Little did we know that what we were getting involved in. The first few moments were kind of fun. We laughed. We enjoyed the funny feeling inside our tummies. After a while, it got to be not so much fun. And after some more time, way past the length of an ordinary ride, I began to feel queasy. I wanted to get out, but I couldn't. First, we were going too fast to escape. Second, the centrifugal force had me pressed firmly against the back of the car. I was immobilized. Every time we spun past the operator, I looked pleadingly at him. Please, read my eyes. I need to get off. But the operator kept the ride going. I guess he thought he'd let it run until more customers showed up. And after another few minutes, the ride became miserable. I remember this one ride where we were on one of the spinning things. I thought I was going to die from a heart attack. Do you remember that? I don't know. I remember that. I just like, oh my gosh, when's this guy going to end? Only after after a few minutes, the ride became miserable. The funny feeling inside my stomach had turned into a churning concoction that I had a faint resemblance of my morning's breakfast. I had no control over my life. I was caught going around in circles, held down by a merciless carnival ride operator. Only after what seemed like 3 or 4 hours did he finally relent and stop the ride. I'm sure I looked completely green at this time. I staggered off the platform, made it about 20 feet where I bent over and lost my breakfast. Of course, my kids gathered around cheering me on. They thought that this was the best part of the ride. See, that's what sin does to you, doesn't it? At first, it's kind of fun. It's kind of, woohoo! Can we ride a little longer than normal? Oh, yeah! But it will eventually take you and not let you go. And around you go. And gang, we have to get to that point where we're sick of it. It'd really be really sweet if we'd get sick with it the first time around, you know, and not have to go for 20 minutes. But see, it's sometimes that's the turning point in our life, isn't it? When you're finally sick enough to do something about it. Oh, that we would just get sick of it and stay away from it. Verse 20, so he says, Who, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? He answers it in the first part of the next verse. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. Now, you almost need to have another verse after this and not have the rest of this, because that's what's always confused me over the years, that he goes on with the rest of the verse. But really, this is the end of the thought. Victory comes from Jesus. Who will deliver me from this body of death? He says, I thank God through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Victory comes from Jesus. But you know, it kind of starts with us getting to the point where we're sick of it. Where I cry out, oh, wretched man that I am. I remember times where I've been laying on my bedroom floor crying out, oh, God, wretched man that I am. Jesus is the one who answers the cry when we say, who will deliver me? Verse 25, now he goes back and sums up what he's just said. And he says, so then, with the mind, I serve the law of God. Because remember up to this point in the chapter, he's been talking about the law of God. He's been talking about the law is not bad, it's not evil, it's a good thing. The law is righteous, it's holy. We talked about that last week. And so he says, So then with the mind I serve the law of God. There's a part of me that's going to be serving God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. He's not giving an excuse for sinning like the person who's shooting up with drugs and saying, well, I may be sinning with my flesh, but right now in my mind I'm serving God. You know, and giving myself another shot. That's not what he's talking about. He's bringing up, again, the dual nature that we struggle with daily as Christians. We have a part of us that is now finally able to serve God because of what Jesus has done for us. But even then, there's going to be a part of me, my flesh, that's going to want to sin. I never get away from that. I never get away from that. There may be times where I think I've hit a plateau and I'm doing good. That's good. That's good. But understand, you've never gotten away from it. You may be having a break. You may be doing good. That's cool. Praise God. But I have never gotten away from it. Even the most righteous Christian has a sin nature. You know, we'll point to Billy Graham. We'll point to Chuck Smith. Point to Greg Laurie. Even they have a sin. I know that I do. So I guess I'm just not one of the greats. No. See, the problem is, we all have a sin nature. Every one of us still has a sin nature. I like the New Living Translation here, where he says, thank God the answer is in Jesus Christ our Lord, period. And then this phrase, this last part, he says, so you see how it is in my mind, I really want to obey God's law, but because of my sinful nature, I am a slave to sin. So I've got this struggle, this tension here. And the last thing I just want to leave you with, I kind of hinted at this when we talked about that word blepo, where I see another law in my members. Here, the point is this. Face reality. Even though we may from time to time be experiencing these plateaus of victory in Jesus, and you know, hopefully we will, and I'm not saying that we're all stuck in the same sin. No. We deal with a sin, we move on, we make sure that we're not overconfident in that sin, and we move on, and God will start dealing with other areas of our sin. And we keep growing to be more and more like Him. But the truth is, you never get away from it. It's gonna be a constant struggle. It takes time to grow in Jesus. A great theologian, lead singer of U2, Bono, had some good words. He said this, your nature is a hard thing to change. It takes time. I've heard of people who have life-changing, miraculous turnarounds, people set free from addiction after a single prayer, relationships saved where both parties let go and let God. But it was not like that for me. For all that I was lost and I am found, it is probably more accurate to say I was really lost. I'm a little less lost at the moment. There's probably truth in that, you know. Because there's a sense that in our living, in our walking, our day-to-day life as Christians, we keep moving forward. We keep moving forward. We've never arrived. We won't arrive till we get to heaven, till we see Him face to face. We need to face that. We need to be aware of that. And that's who we are. Let's stand and pray.